Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. I'm Brian Toporek, and joining me today are not my usual co-hosts, Sarah and Morton, but instead we have Jeff McMenamin. You can find his work at Sixers Blog on Twitter. He is a writer for Metro Philly and B-Ball Breakdown, and he also has a podcast at 76ers Report. How's it going, Jeff?
Great, Brian. Thanks for having me on, and I'm ready. We've followed each other on Twitter for a while now, and read each other's work. So I'm excited to talk some Sixers basketball today, and everything kind of surrounding what's been going on with the team.
Sure thing. Yeah, I wish it would be under better circumstances. We will talk some general Sixers draft stuff, as well as talk later about Game 1 in the finals and Game 2. Unfortunately, we have to start with the rumor that brought Sixers Twitter to a halt on Thursday. The vertical Shams Charania broke the story that the Sixers and the Atlanta Hawks are talking about a deal involving Nerlens Noel and Jeff Teague. Shams said there is nothing imminent, but Keith Pompey of the Philadelphia Inquirer later added that the Sixers would also consider adding Nick Stauskas or Robert Covington to the deal. So, Jeff, I mean, long-term listeners of the podcast will probably know how I feel about this, because there's at least a five-minute segment every time where I try to come up with Jahlil Okafor trade rumors. But what was your first thought when you saw that report on Thursday?
Well, first, we had to weather the storm of that semi Derrick Rose rumor to the Bulls. So when this Teague news came out, a little shocking to say the least. Obviously Shams is a much better source there when it comes to the rumor. So I mean, at first I was just like, does this even make any sense? I mean, why why bring in Jeff Teague, who is on the final year of his deal here in Atlanta? Why bring him over when, he'll be 29 to start, the free agency process next year? Mm-hmm. Do you really want to pay a guy like Jeff Teague, who, don't get me wrong, he's a good player, probably a top 15 point guard in the league. But why pay a guy, on the downswing of his career, maybe a max contract for next summer? And especially for a player like Nerlens. I mean, Nerlens, he's been a defensive anchor throughout his career in Philadelphia. Where would this team be defensively without him the past couple of years? Especially his rookie season, he just posted incredible numbers last season. We'll probably get into it in a bit, but, yep. His fit with Okafor, didn't really show his numbers as well. But yeah, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And when you toss in a Robert Covington into that deal, who who also is a very valuable commodity, especially with that contract he has, the whole thing just didn't make any sense. And that was my initial reaction, and I've kind of stuck to that since then.
Yeah, I'm right with you. Derek Bodner, who is a great Sixers follow, he writes for Philly Mag, had a really good column, I believe, on Friday, kind of breaking down the issues regarding Teague's fit in Philly. And I think it's worth stressing that, a lot of the negative reaction at first was people saying, like, why Jeff Teague? Like, what? He's not that good. I mean, we need to separate. He's a fine point guard. You said it. He's like probably above average, top 15. Like, there is no question Jeff Teague, the player, makes the Sixers better next season. Like, that is not the issue. The issue, as you said, he's 29 when he becomes a free agent in 2017. He'll be an unrestricted free agent. So the Sixers, it's not like when Nerlens becomes a restricted free agent, he can get a max deal and they could at least have the right to refuse to match it.
Of course.
Teague, they don't have that, so they might be trading Nerlens for a guy who walks in a year anyway. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't walk, as you said, you're probably paying him a max or a near max deal. I mean, that's my big issue, is like, if you really want Jeff Teague, just wait a year and max exactly. him out then. Yeah. And don't give up Nerlens for him. It's I don't understand why you would give up an asset for like a very valuable asset, and frankly, like your best Joel Embiid insurance. If Embiid's never healthy, yes. like yeah. Nerlens can be your defensive anchor. I don't get why you give that up for a guy who could leave in a year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't even mention that, but yeah, I mean, being unrestricted is a huge part of it. If you can just go after the guy in free agency next year while keeping Nerlens and Robert Covington, you know, there's no reason to go after the guy now and give up that much. I mean, it's
right.
it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you, you know, go after Schroeder, it makes a little bit more sense. You know, maybe mm-hmm. if you go after Schroeder, who had 11 points, 3 rebounds, 4 assists last year, you know, he's thought of as a solid defender. You know, he's kind of on the upward swing of his career. 2 more years left on his contract. You know, if they did a deal for Schroeder, toss in maybe their 21st pick this year, 17 first rounder, you know, that might make a little bit more sense. But in terms of this Jeff Teague rumor, you know, I'm definitely not on board. And for all the reasons you mentioned, and, you know, you don't want to, you know, test your luck on possibly a 1-year rental while giving up that much.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think you brought up, I mean, the age thing is also a huge factor. Like, not only will he probably be on the decline by the end of that deal, like, your best players right now are all in their early 20s. So by the time they're like good, hitting their primes, 25, 26, Teague's going to be 32, 33. Like yeah. he's going to be at the, you know, the tail end of his relevance as a starting point guard. So it's like, it's just another thing. Like what are you thinking trying to target this kind of a player? I mean, I think you're right. The Schroeder would make a lot more sense. I mean, I would assume the Hawks probably covered him more than Jeff Teague. I think there were a couple of reports around the trade deadline that they liked Schroeder's competitiveness, which Teague doesn't always show. Mm-hmm. So I would assume they would ask a little bit more if you're going to go after him, especially because, like Nerlens, he'll be a restricted free agent, so at least you have the possibility of matching with him. And
yeah.
the Sixers were linked to him around the trade deadline, even when Sam Hinkie was in charge. So interest there makes sense. Is there anything Atlanta could include in this deal that would make it worthwhile?
I mean, I think pretty much just the one I just laid out for Schroeder. I mean, there's really nothing else that entices me on their roster. You know, it would have been Kent Bazemore, but he's a
yeah.
you know, free agent this summer. So yeah, I mean, outside of Schroeder, there's really nothing that entices me, and it's not like they're gonna, you know, be able to pry Paul Millsap from them in a trade. So
right,
you know, it's pretty much you know, Dennis Schroeder or bust.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, I mean, they don't even have the, you know, they could throw in, as you mentioned, an unprotected first round pick, but it's not like, I mean, they're a pretty good team. Like, even if they give away Teague or they give away Schroeder, like, it's probably gonna be enough to make the playoffs anyway, so you're probably looking at a pick in the early 20s. Like yeah. that's not, it's not a huge deal swinger. Mm-hmm. I think the big question here, you know, Sham said nothing is imminent with this trade,
and yeah.
hopefully the very, very negative reaction from Sixers Twitter will at least help push them away from this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Pompey said they were shopping Nerlens and Jahlil Okafor to at least 15 teams. So I think for whatever reason this leaked, I don't know. But I do wonder, does this give you more concerns or less confidence about Brian Colangelo as a general manager?
I think mainly it makes me question his motive, because mm-hmm. you know, if we're really trying to rebuild and keep the trend going that Sam Hinkie set forth, this completely, you know, blows that away. You know, you can't try to, you know, keep going with the rebuild and then try to win now by bringing in a player like Jeff Teague, which would do exactly that.
Right.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's just an odd odd thing that they're even mentioned in a rumor like this. And it's also just strange seeing Brian Colangelo as the public speaker and inside source throughout this process compared to Sam Hinkie, because this would never even be on the radar if, you know, Sam Hinkie was general manager. You know, there was, you know, a little talk before the trade deadline that, you know, the Hawks and Sixers were in talks over Teague and Schroeder, but, you know, Nerlens Noel was not part of any of that conversation. And it's, you know, definitely alarming to see, you know, a player as important to your franchise as Nerlens to be possibly sold for a 1 year rental.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at the trade deadline, it was Ish Smith and then Stauskas, and I don't even think Covington was involved from what I remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Covington was, maybe, but yeah, I mean, significantly less than what was being talked
right.
about. Now.
Right, yeah, yeah, I mean, you know, I literally, like, the other day at today's Fast Break wrote a column praising Brian Colangelo because he went on the radio recently and talked about wanting to sign, like, placeholder free agents, so kind of guys on, like, short-term deals as... Because he knows, like, the Sixers won 10 games last year. They're not going to attract Kevin Durant. You're not going to get Mike Conley.
Yeah.
You're probably not even going to get, like, a Chandler Parsons or, I mean, maybe even a Kent Bazemore. Like, a lot of those guys are trying to go to teams that are more competitive.
Yeah.
So unless you, like, egregiously overpay them on long-term deals, they're not going to come to Philly. So he's saying, all right, let's, you know, let's do what the Kings did last year, sign Rondo to a one-year deal. Get a little more competitive, and then bigger name free agents will consider us in 2017, you know, once Embiid plays, once our number one pick has a season under his belt. So I was like all for Brian Colangelo. Like, you know what? This is like, this is exactly the type of mindset you need to have.
Yeah.
You should not be going after, I mean, you have $60 million in cap space. So if they want, they can max out two guys,
of course.
Like, don't do that just because you can. Like, you know, we've talked about this with Morton and Sarah in previous podcasts. Like, Harrison Barnes is going to get a max deal.
Yep.
Like, I don't want the Sixers to be the team to do that. You know, he's a good player, but, like, I don't know that he's necessarily worth a max, and he's going to get one just because of the screwed up fiscal environment this summer with the cap rising so much. So, like, our definition of a max player is going to change, but especially with, like, the collective bargaining agreement, probably there's probably going to be an opt out this year. Like, just wait a year, see how that affects things. Like, you know, for all we know, they're going to remove max contracts entirely, or they're going to raise the percentage of what a max player can get. So, like, maybe the next CBA, it is really impossible to form a quote unquote super team. Like, the Warriors would not have the space to sign a Kevin Durant. So maybe, like, it makes sense to preserve your cap space to see what happens then. Because if you can, like, you know, if you have 50, 60 million in cap space and you can suddenly give a huge portion of that to a player, you know, not even a LeBron or a KD, but, like, someone in the 10 to 20 range, like, you know, Boogie Cousins or, I don't know, LaMarcus Aldridge. Like, obviously you don't want to do it to big guys because you got plenty of those, but someone in that, like, caliber of player, if you can lure those players with that cap space, that's awesome. But now, having seen this trade rumor, I have no faith again, and I am officially, I'm just terrified of the next month, because I'm going to be checking Twitter every day compulsively, just like, oh God, what did he do this time?
Yeah, one thing I found kind of interesting, you know, people on Twitter have brought it up to me, you know, what is Nerlens Noel's kind of value at this point? You know, is he a max guy? You know, do the Sixers see him as a max guy? Is that why maybe, you know, he might be rumored in, you know, involvement in a trade at this point? Do they see him as a building block moving forward? And, you know, maybe is that the reason why they're trying to get something for him now before it becomes an issue where they have to pay him down the road?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I mean, I don't think there's any pressure to sign him to an extension this summer. If he's demanding a max and he won't settle for a dollar less,
yeah,
there's no point in signing him to an extension because he's a restricted free agent. So yeah. Let him go get that offer. Like, if that's how he values himself, you know, make him get that offer from another team and then just match it. And yeah. At that point, you get, like, slightly smaller raises. You know, it comes with one less year on the deal, but you still have him locked up for four more years.
Yeah.
If you can convince him to sign less than the max this summer, I think you do it immediately.
Yeah.
Because any deal signed this summer under a $92 million cap, it's going to be a huge steal compared in a $107-108 million, which it's going to jump to
The
following year. Uh-huh. So I actually wrote a column at bballbreakdown.com about this whole, which guy should they trade, Nerlens or Okafor? And that was kind of my, I'm pretty firmly on the trade Okafor camp. But I did say, you know, if Nerlens is demanding a max and he's not willing to budge from that, that might push you to trade him. Or, I mean, ideally, like, ultimately, he's probably, whichever one you keep, you're probably moving them to the bench. Because, like, you, in a perfect world, Joel Embiid would be healthy. He will avoid any more setbacks. Yeah. He's going to be your starting five. And then, presumably, they're going to take Ben Simmons at number one. So he's going to be your starting four. Like,
yeah.
Neither one of these guys is going to be a starter in a year or two in a perfect world. So if Nerlens is not okay with that role, then you have to start weighing whether he's part of your long-term future as well.
And I don't really see Okafor as, you know, wanting to be in that role either.
Right.
Realistically, I think they both are bench players on a good team. You know, if you look at the Thunder and, mm-hmm. and their year they had, it's funny because, you know, they have a similar setup with Steven Adams and Enes Kanter on their team where, you know, one is the offensive juggernaut off the bench and the other is the defensive juggernaut off the bench. And, you know, I think they need both equally on that team to be successful. And I don't know if you can really value the presence of one over the other, but right. I think in today's NBA and the way things are going, I just think Noel is a better fit.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I've been hammering that Okafor Enes Kanter comparison all year because I really think that is his perfect role for now. And I agree he's not going to willingly accept that, but like, dude can't defend pick and rolls at all. Like in my article, I have a video of him defending pick and rolls and it's egregious. Like he doesn't even move.
Yeah.
He's often just standing there flat footed 15 feet from the guy he's supposed to guard. Uh-huh. And I don't know. Part of it might be strategy. Like that might just be the team's defensive game plan is like, you're too slow or you don't understand how to guard these. So we're not going to have you like hedge out to the guard at all. We're going to keep you near the basket, but like that's mm-hmm. leaving wide open jump shots. You can't have that in your starting lineup and expect to like have any sort of defensive discipline whatsoever. So until he gets good at defending those, yeah, like I think his best role is just coming off the bench. And I mean, he's already a fantastic scorer. Like his offensive skill set is insane. Especially yes. for a guy his size, like he's 6'10", 270, but he can actually create off the dribble better than I realized coming into the year.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, yeah, I mean, I would love to see him come off the bench. And if he's willing to, and Nerlens isn't, you know, that might make it a little more even in the who should you trade debate. Like, because, again, I think he would be really good in that role. But I'm with you. I don't think he would agree to it. And if Embiid does not avoid any setbacks,
yeah,
I'm more hesitant with Okafor as my starting five than I am with Nerlens because I cover this in the column. But I mean, you said it earlier too. Like his rookie year, they were 12th or tied for 12th in defensive rating.
Yeah.
Even though, like, if you look at that roster, it is a crime scene. Like, yeah. Especially after they traded MCW, like, it is just the I mean, I think Henry Sims started, like, 30-plus games for that team. Like, that team had no business being anywhere like within the top half of the league, within the top 20. And this year they regressed a lot. They were right. I think they were 25th this year. But a lot of that, you know, people have been, some people have been saying like Nerlens regressed defensively, which he did slightly. I mean, just in terms of steals and blocks per game. But like, if you look at his on-off stats with the worst defenders, with Okafor, with Nick Stauskas, with Isaiah Kanan, with Ish Smith, like when those guys weren't on the floor, the Sixers defended much better. But it was like, of course he's gonna, his like team-wide defensive rating is gonna dip when you're playing New Orleans with like two or three of those guys, because those guys are all huge liabilities. Like,
yeah,
it's not New Orleans' fault that they're getting scored on. It's just like, oh, Jahlil Okafor just literally stood there flat-footed as a dude canned a jump shot in his face.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, Nerlens just, I think someone mentioned on Twitter the other day how he basically, you know, led the team to that 12th in the league defensive rating when he's playing with a rec league team out there, you know.
Right. Yeah,
it's it was just insane, you know, the amount of you know, impact he had on the game. And you know, his defensive box score was just insane that mm-hmm. year. I think he was like second or third in the league in defensive box score. So yeah, I mean, it's something that they'll have to definitely really, really examine, you know, if they're getting rid of a guy like that who's so elite on the defensive end. You know, every team needs that in the NBA today, whereas, you know, I feel like, you know, teams can find other routes, especially with the way things are going for perimeter shooting in the NBA, to find, you know, additional scoring where they wouldn't need a player like Jahlil Okafor.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, look at Bismack Biyombo. Like, the guy is probably going to get $15 million a year just because he can rebound really well and block a couple shots. Like, you're telling me Nerlens Noel is not better than Bismack Biyombo?
Yeah.
You know, like, I noted this in the column. There's some perception that Noel is only, like, a rim protector, but he's actually, as a rookie, he was tied for second in the league in deflections per 100 chances, which
yeah.
is a Vantage sports stat.
Uh-huh.
And then this past year, he led the league. Like, his defensive instincts are insane. Like, he is just so good at jumping into passing lanes, and his hands are so quick, and he's got great body control that, like, a ball handler can be dribbling by him, and he just, like, reaches out
yeah.
and, like, thwacks it away. And it might not result in a turnover, but it's still waste time on the shot clock, and it, like, makes opponents uncomfortable offensively. Which,
uh-huh.
I mean, look at the Oklahoma City Golden State series for, like, an example of how well that can work. Like, look at how well Kevin Durant just got into their heads for a while
yep.
because his long arms were just everywhere. And,
uh-huh.
they, you know, they thought, like, they're trying to make the passes they always make, but, like, KD just gets in the way. And I mean, that's Nerlens. Like, that is what he brings to the table.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. I mean, there was a quote, I think an NBA executive told this to Keith Pompey of the Inquirer in January when they was talking about, like, which guy do you trade? And they're like, Okafor impacts the game in one area, scoring. Noel just does so much more for the team
yeah.
that I think you have to keep him and trade Okafor. And that's, again, not to say Okafor is a bad player by any means. I think on the right team he could be great, and I
yeah.
you know, I would be surprised if he didn't develop into a 2010 guy one day. I just don't know. I have more confidence in building, if neither guy improves on their weaknesses at all, I have more confidence building around a defensive stalwart who is limited offensively, because you can
uh-huh.
as you said, find other ways to score. But, like, if you're building around a center who can't defend pick and rolls, like,
yeah,
that's a huge issue. And I mean, Okafor is a decent post defender. I mean, I had some stats in my article that, you know, he actually, I think, held opponents to 7 percentage points below their average around the rim,
yeah,
or a little less than seven, but same idea. Like he's got the frame and he has the body. He's actually not a total lost cause on defense in that regard, but because pick and rolls are just so, I mean, every team runs so many, like you have to have a guy who knows how to guard them, and he doesn't. So that's a huge issue.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, when you look at Okafor's ceiling as a player, what, it might be like an Al Jefferson, like a Nick Vucevic, like a Greg Monroe. Does that really entice you as, you know, one of your building blocks in your starting lineup?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think you nailed it. And I think, you know, look at, I mean, New Orleans doesn't have the frame of like DeAndre Jordan. I don't think he's ever going to grow into that type of a, but like Tyson Chandler,
yeah,
I could totally see. And it might sound like sacrilegious because Tyson Chandler is a, you know, NBA champion, like an all defensive player, but I really think Nerlens has that same type of upside. And, you know, his jump shot very much remains a work in progress, but I don't get the impression that he's, you know, we've heard reports both off seasons, like he's in New Hampshire right now, like taking 1,000 jump shots a day. Like he's, you know, he's working on it. Yeah. I think he was playing out of position a lot this year, so that probably complicated things just in terms of his offensive flow. But I have more faith in him developing offensively than I do in Jahlil developing defensively. And again, even if they both stagnate right here, I just think it's a lot easier to build around the defensive guy just because he can impact every possession on D. Whereas Okafor, I mean, your best case scenario, you're not going to dump it down to him on every single possession. There are going to be some where he doesn't touch the ball. So I think Nerlens just has a bigger impact overall. You know, both of us are obviously pretty adamantly against this Teague for Noel trade, but if you did have to trade one of those guys, what would you hope to receive in exchange?
Well, my mindset is I'm not trading Nerlens Noel. So I will strictly, I guess, give a trade, some trade scenarios for Okafor that I would be okay with. I think I wrote an article recently for the Metro that went into it a little bit. But I think number three from Boston for Okafor would be a fair deal. And, you know, maybe the Sixers would try to sweeten it and get Avery Bradley in that deal, too. I don't know what that would take. You know, maybe they would have to package both of those 24 and 26 to pry Avery Bradley away at this point. I'm not sure. So I think that would be fair. I think I mentioned D'Angelo Russell, just a straight up swap with the Lakers there. I don't know. I'm a little less you know, on board with that move just because, you know, Russell himself had a pretty rough year and, you know, he's not really a point guard. He's more of a shooting guard. So that would be a little dicey there if you're giving away Okafor. And also, I'm just not really a fan of the Lakers in general. So making them happy in a trade, I wouldn't be for that.
That's fair.
And then I think I mentioned Phoenix as another trade partner. They have pick number four, and, you know, they don't really have anything in the front court. They have, you know, an aging Tyson Chandler. I think he's 33 right now.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, he's definitely towards the end of his career. And then they have Alex Len, who has just severely underperformed since they drafted him. So getting a guy like Okafor in there, especially since they're still in kind of the rebuild mode, you know, that would be a welcome addition when they already have a backcourt in, you know, for the moment, Brandon Knight and Eric Bledsoe. So, yeah, I think those are all three reasonable trades for Okafor. And, you know, maybe, you know, even the Suns might be willing to get rid of Bledsoe in a trade there. Yeah. And, you know, with Brian Colangelo saying he kind of wants to, you know, if he makes a trade, kind of get a star player in return. You know, Eric Bledsoe is that type of guy. Just you don't know whether or not he'll fully be healthy season.
Right.
So,
yeah, I mean, right after the Sixers won the number one pick and the lottery kind of unfolded, I proposed number three straight up for Okafor to Morton and Sarah, and both of them shot me down immediately if they were Boston. So I was like, uh-oh, because, right, I mean, the days after the lottery, like, on Sixers Twitter, all of us were like, what about 3-16 for him, or 3-Bradley, or 3-Marcus Smart? So it seems like 3 straight up is probably where the value would end up. I would be, you know, at first I was a little lukewarm on that, but I've since come around, which we could talk about shortly. I like Russell. I mean, I'm very high on him still.
Okay.
So I would do that in a heartbeat. I mean, I think honestly, if they basically swapped last year and the Lakers took Okafor 2 and the Sixers had Russell 3, Sam Hinkie would still be the general manager.
Yep.
He would not have the number one pick. Like, he's that kind of a, you know, he just a huge upgrade, and the Sixers don't have a point guard. So that would help. I do like Phoenix if they would be willing. I mean, I'm wondering, like Alex Len, as you said, he's been kind of a disappointment. I think it's mostly been he just can't stay healthy. He's had some ankle injuries.
Yeah.
So I wonder where Phoenix is in terms of their valuation of him. And I mean, he's in the same class as Nerlens, so he's going to be a restricted free agent next summer. So yeah, if they were willing to do like number 4, and I think I would assume they're higher on Bledsoe than they are on Brandon Knight. If I was them, I would value Bledsoe even with the injury issues more than Knight. And then, you know, Devin Booker, like, he broke out this year. I think he's their starting 2 moving forward. So I think you basically have to, I mean, one of Bledsoe or Knight are moving to the bench anyway, and I don't think you're paying. Now their contracts will be reasonable, but you're still paying $13-14 million a year for a guy coming off the bench. That's not an ideal use of resources. So if they could do Okafor, it would probably have to be Okafor and something. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Covington.
I mean, yeah, probably Covington and for Knight and 4, which I would at least be amenable to that. I wouldn't be thrilled to give up Covington, but I think that's reasonable. This is a good way we can just pivot right into some draft talk, because I think a lot of what they do both later with their own picks and then also if they're going to trade Okafor for a pick depends on what they do at number 1. So are you team Simmons or team Ingram?
You know, I'm still kind of split. You know, I've been you know, following both of them since last July. So, you know,
being a Sixers fan.
It's been a long year of, you know, really diving into both of their skill sets, seeing where they would fit on the Sixers. And, you know, we had Andrew Johnson of Nylon Calculus on our last show on the 76ers report. And, you know, he kind of, you know, steered me more towards Simmons, just in the sense that, you know, you should not base your draft on fit. It should always be best player available. Mm-hmm. And clearly Ben Simmons is the best player available.
Yep.
But I mean, it's hard to pass on a guy getting comparisons to Kevin Durant, you know, with the 7'2" wingspan. You know, you look at the defensive potential he has there. You can plug him in at the 3, you know, from day 1, and you won't have to worry about so many of those questions in the front court, you know, who you're going to trade, you know, who you're going to kind of build the back court around Simmons with. So there's a lot more questions than answers, I feel like, with drafting Ben Simmons when it comes to the Sixers roster decisions. And I do think that, you know, Ingram is going to be an elite scorer once he, you know, puts on some pounds and gets into the flow of an NBA team's offense. And especially with just the way the NBA is moving forward, you know, you have the Warriors and the Cavs meeting in the finals, you know, the first time in NBA history that, you know, those two teams meeting in the finals were first and second respectively in 3-point field goals made during the regular season. So, you know, there's a lot of those things that run through my mind when it comes to the pick at number 1. So I'm still split I think I would like Ingram more, just strictly, you know, the way the NBA is trending. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the Sixers will ultimately pick Ben Simmons.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be honest, I've been pretty firmly Simmons the whole time. And yeah. I get the argument for Ingram, and I agree with everything you said. Like, it is much easier to imagine plugging him in day one and not having to worry about the front court glut. I mean, yeah, he projects as an elite scorer, an elite three-point shooter, 6'9", 7'2 wingspan, 7'3 wingspan. Like,
yeah.
He's going to be a defensive freak once he fills out a little bit.
But, yeah.
I mean, I just think that Simmons, like, we've seen it with LeBron and with Draymond Green, the value of having a playmaking four.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so impressive what those guys can do. Yeah. And I don't know that you put Ben Simmons as your full-time point guard, but just having his ability, you know, if you put him in pick and rolls and you have him as the role man, like,
yeah,
he can make plays after he gets the ball as the role man. Like, it would just be, he presents such challenges, especially for opposing forwards to guard him.
Yeah.
That even though, you know, the big concerns with him are his shooting. He's not a great three-point shooter, even though we've seen some videos from, like, Chad Ford showing him hitting, you know, every NBA player can hit a standstill three-pointer in practice. Like, I'm not putting too much stock into any draft workout videos. So, I mean, that's a big concern, especially if you keep both Nerlens and Okafor, neither one of those guys you want out past 10, 15 feet. So, like, the spacing will get crowded. I do just think he is the best talent, and I'm with the guy on Nylon Calculus. I wrote something for FanSided about this. Like, you just, at number one, you cannot take fit into the equation, especially because there's no one on the Sixers roster. I mean, Nerlens is the closest one, but there's no one who has come and, like, proven to be a franchise cornerstone. And I think Embiid is really the only one who could get there. And I think Simmons and Embiid, with Embiid's ability to knock down mid-range and long-range shots, like, I think that combination could be so scary together if they both max out their potential. I mean, admittedly a big if, but I just really, really think that would be so huge. And then Brett Brown's relationship with the Simmons family, I think,
yeah, gives of course. A big,
you know, that gives him a big leg up. Like, if those are one of the concerns about him, and who better to find out than, you know, from his father, who you've known for 20, 30 years. So I'm not worried about that as much. You know, I do think whoever they choose at one will influence what they do moving forward, either with trading Okafor and Noel. So, you know, let's go back to that hypothetical. Say they trade Okafor to Boston for number three. Say Morton and Sarah were wrong to shoot me down for that. If they do that, who would you pick there?
Yeah, so, I mean, it all depends on if they take Simmons or Ingram.
Right.
You know, if they pick Simmons, I feel like you have to go with the best shooter at number three, and that would be Jamal Murray.
Yeah.
You know, he projects to be the best shooter next season. I think his projection is to be around 39% from three. Yeah. So that's, you know, a quality addition. You know, you're going to need to surround Simmons with LeBron-like players, you know, with the J.R. Smiths and, you know, Kyrie Irvings of the world. So, you know, I think that they would go Murray if they pick Simmons. And I think if you pick Ingram, you get Chris Dunn as the point guard of the team at number three. So, I think it's pretty much those two. You know, they're the next tier outside of Dragon Bender. You know, they're the next tier of, you know, potential star players, I guess, coming out of this draft.
Right. Yeah. And I know the guys at Sixers beat, Derek Bodner and Max Rappaport and all those guys, they are pretty firmly in the Dragon Bender camp, just in a hypothetical world. Because they think he's the third best talent. And then, you know, he's going to be playing, in theory, he's, like, just not ready to jump into a 30-minute per game role, so he would be playing 15, 20 minutes a night. He's not going to really contribute to the front court glut, so you can kind of figure out if Dario Saric is everything they think he is, and if Embiid can stay healthy. And as much as I get that argument, I just don't think optics-wise, Brian Colangelo is going to trade Jahlil Okafor for a dude who's playing 15 minutes a night. Like, I just, you know, you can't say you want to, like, go from process to progress and then make a trade like that where it's like, oh, wow, you know, you just traded a 17-7 guy for, like, a 18-year-old skinny European who's barely playing. Like, it's just, you know, I get that he might be the third best prospect, but I'm with you. I mean, if I take Simmons, I definitely take Jamal Murray third. And, I admittedly have not done, like, enough research into what his big weaknesses is, but from what I can tell, the big concern with him is that he's not really, like, a true point guard. He's not, like, a great facilitator yet. But if you take Ben Simmons, like, isn't that the type of player that enables you to take?
Exactly. You won't get that ball-hawking point guard. You know, Chris Dunn draws those John Wall comparisons, so he's going to need the ball in his hand a good amount. Right. I just don't see the fit where, you know, you have a point forward like Ben Simmons and also, you know, a point guard like that who needs the ball in his hands.
Yeah, it seems like Murray, you know, you said he's like, he projects to be a 40% shooter right away, which is exactly what you need, a guy who's going to be a great three-point shooter if you're building around Simmons at the four and, you know, hopefully Embiid, but probably either Nerlens or Okafor at the five, like two guys who are going to be operating from within the three-point line. So you need to have, ideally, three shooters around them, and one of them will be Robert Covington, maybe one of them is Nick Stauskas, and then, you know, Murray there at the point. I'm worried that they take Buddy Hield there, just because he's a little bit older, and, you know, he does, like, scoring and three-point shooting are the things that he projects to do well at the next level, even though I think that's it. Like, I think his upside is like a low ceiling starter or probably like a sixth man ultimately.
Yeah.
So I would not want to do that. I mean, yeah, I'm right with you with Murray. I'm glad. I was preparing a defense. Like, I thought you might be in the Bender camp. So I was really preparing to fight for Murray, but there we go. We both agree on that. What would you want to see them do with their two late first round picks, numbers 24 and 26?
So, like I, you know, alluded to earlier, I think that those are both kind of sweeteners in the Okafor deal, or it could be to, you know, move back into like a mid-round pick. And I think that, you know, there's some decent options there if you are looking to, you know, go back into maybe like the 10 to 15 range in the draft. You know, I think, you know, point guard Wade Baldwin from Vanderbilt. He's, you know, a quality guy who can, you know, shoot pretty well. And I think he's a good enough facilitator that he could play along Ben Simmons while not taking away, you know, everything that Ben Simmons does there. You know, I'm very high on Taurean Prince, but his average draft position is kind of all over the place. I think that, you know, he reminds me so much of kind of Kawhi Leonard and in his ceiling of what he can do. You know, he's a very good scorer in the paint, you know, very good shooter. He can defend very well. You know, he's your typical kind of 3-and-D wing that I think, you know, would fit in just fine with the Sixers. You know, a lot of people are high on Demetrius Jackson from Notre Dame. I don't really know what his ceiling can be. You know, he had a very good season last year for Notre Dame, and he's kind of the reason why they went to the Elite Eight, just, you know, how good he was in the NCAA tournament for them. And actually, Denzel Valentine is a guy that, you know, if you want to take Ben Simmons at number one and you also want to get kind of that small forward that does everything, you know, that's Denzel Valentine. I think, you know, when we had Andrew Johnson on from Nylon Calculus on our last show, he actually has Valentine rated above Buddy Hield. You know, he has Buddy Hield on, he has a list called Do Not Want. Buddy Hield is one of, I think, like, three players in the top 10 that's on that list. And he's actually rated below Valentine, who I think is projected 20th on Draft Express's, you know, mock draft right now. So it's interesting. I think, you know, Valentine is kind of that guy who could do everything as well, who's also a very good defender. And I just like Michigan State guys in general.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, what Tom Izzo does up there, what kind of hazing he does as a coach, or what's in the water in Michigan. But it seems like all these guys that come out of Michigan State are just rock solid defenders, and you can really plug them into, you know, your lineup without having to, you know, kind of let them grow for a couple of years. You know, they're NBA ready coming out of Michigan State.
Yeah, I think Denzel Valentine's going to get, like, the Draymond Green bump, because people are just going to think he's, like, two or three inches shorter, but the same type of player. And he's well-rounded. Like, I don't think he is. I mean, what makes Dre special is that he's such a good playmaking forward, like I said earlier, you know, in the mold of a Simmons or of a LeBron. And that's, it puts such a unique strain on defenses, whereas Valentine, you know, probably switches between the two and the three. So at least the guys guarding him are more used to guarding that kind of player. But I'm with you. I love him. I would absolutely, I mean, if he slipped to 24, pounce on a heartbeat, or if you can package those two and move up to like 18 or something, that would be awesome. I'm right with you on Wade Baldwin. I think, like, my ideal scenario would be Simmons at one, Murray at three, and then somehow move back into like the 15 range and get Baldwin. Doubt Brian Colangelo is okay having three rookie starters, and then Embiid's a rookie and Dario Saric is a rookie. You know, it's probably a little too young, but I just think Murray and Baldwin would be such a perfect fit next to Simmons that it would be worth the lumps you take in 2016, 2017. I like Patrick McCaw a lot. I think he's he's really skinny right now, but he's got great length, and he's at least projects, from what I can tell, as a decent shooter. You know, Tyler Ulis, if they don't get a point guard, could be interesting. I mean, Brian Colangelo has said that they are not going to use all three picks, basically, or they're going to trade one, or, you know, draft and stash someone, which is fine, because, like, you know, Embiid is, for all intents and purposes, going to be a rookie. And then Saric, assuming he comes over, is a rookie. So, like, you know, having five rookies on the roster is probably a lot to ask. You know, maybe you can do like a domestic draft and stash and do what the Thunder did with Josh Huestis and put him in the D League. So there are a lot of options there. I just don't think they're going to actually use all three picks on players who are going to be on the roster this coming year. Before we hop over to some brief NBA Finals talk, do you think the one reservation I have with Simmons is I wonder how it affects Saric. Do you think if we take him that Saric would rethink coming over?
You know, I don't. My main worry with Saric is he had such a good relationship with Sam Hinkie, and I don't think that relationship is there with Brian Colangelo. So, you know, I don't think that Saric wouldn't come over just because we draft Ben Simmons. I think it's more, you know, is the relationship there? Does he feel comfortable, you know, playing under Brian Colangelo? So I think that's my main worry. I think that Saric is, you know, a lot of people have actually said that he's repetitive to Ben Simmons, but I just don't really see that. You know, I think that in the past year, you've seen Saric kind of develop into more of that, you know, stretch four that can, you know, hit the outside shot at a pretty repetitive rate. I think he's, what, 41% shooting from three-point range right now. And one thing that has really impressed me is his free throw shooting. I think he's like a 94% free throw shooter.
Oh, wow.
So that, you know, projects very well if, you know, he can just stand out on the wing. I don't know, I guess, how – I don't know if he can play the three.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's fast enough or athletic enough to guard, you know, NBA-caliber wings.
Right.
But I feel like, you know, if he wants to get the most of his minutes, he would almost have to transition into a three in the NBA.
Yeah, I mean – how many teams are like looking for one playmaking four, and the Sixers could have two? Like I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing either. I think it's definitely a position of luxury, and you know, you probably don't want Ben Simmons at the three full time either, but you know, you could at least steal a couple minutes for him there and steal a couple minutes for Saric at the three, or even put one of them at the five. Like, you know, if Golden State has
ball.
Yeah, if they have the death lineup out there and there's not a single player above 6'7", 6'8", like you're fine putting a 6'10" Saric or a 6'10" Simmons at the five. So I hope it doesn't affect anything, because there are severe financial ramifications if he does not come over this year. Like he gets out of the rookie scale, and it would be wildly beneficial for the Sixers for him to come over. So I just I hope that the Simmons thing doesn't affect him at all, but it is in the back of my mind. I know Colangelo and Brett Brown are making a trip overseas, I think next week, sometime in June, to go chat with Saric. And I mean, all reports, even since November, have said he's coming over, but we haven't heard anything definitive since the lottery. So it does make me wonder a little bit. Before you go, I do want to touch on game one of the finals. For those who don't know, your brother Dave actually works for ESPN as the Cavs reporter. So I wanted to know, especially from someone who's probably got some Cavs intel, who did you have in this series before it started? And then did game one change your opinion at all?
Well, I had Golden State in five before the series started. So my opinion has not changed. I still think the Cavs might be able to take one of those games at home.
Mm-hmm.
But I think game one, you know, just further proved my early prediction. You know, when Curry and Thompson combined for 20 points and you still win by 15. And really, you know, the Cavs took a 1-point lead in the third quarter, but really that game was not close whole time. And, you know, I think the final score was indicative of that.
Yeah, I actually also had Golden State in five, so I'm glad we're on the same page there. I think both Morton and Sarah had Golden State in six. And, I saw a lot of, like, really smart people, especially on ESPN, like, even the ones who took Golden State, like, almost everyone had six or seven.
Yeah.
And I was like, am I missing something? Like, I just don't think this is going to be that competitive. And, you know, as you said, like, game one confirmed a lot of those suspicions. It seemed like, you know, after surviving the length of OKC, it was just like the floodgates opened once they got to the Cavs. So do you think there's anything that Cleveland can do, any major adjustments to make to get back into this series? Game two is tonight.
The major adjustment is to get J.R. Smith going. I mean, I think he had, what, four shots in the first game? So, you know, he's got to shoot about 15 to 20 shots, and the majority being from the three-point line, for them to have any shot. I mean, he's probably the best three-point shooter on the team. You know, you could make a Channing Frye or a Kevin Love or Kyrie Irving argument, but you know, I think you know, the volume of three-pointers that, you know, J.R. Smith shoots, you're going to need that to, you know, come close in this series, especially, you know, going against Clay and Steph, who, you know, definitely won't have a performance like they did in game one the rest of the series.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm right with you there. I think, JR was really bad in last year's finals, but I thought, you know, he was basically the number two option once Kyrie went down. So I thought they could, you know, send a lot more defensive attention his way. Now that Kyrie's healthy, it seems like Klay Thompson is marking him most of the time. So, you know, Curry was on J.R. Smith a lot. And if you're hiding Curry on J.R. Smith, J.R. Smith, you're right, he needs to make Curry pay. Like, that's the way to, you know, Curry is not going to be as bad as he was, but if you tire him out, make him run around a lot of screens, like wear him down physically, that's your best chance. So I'm with you that JR needs to have a much better game. I also, you know, before the series started, I said Kevin Love was the big swing factor here because I just didn't see a single player, especially in the starting lineup, that he can really competently guard. And those fears held true in game one. I just think you either need to cut back on his minutes significantly, or you even need to just put him on the bench and start like Shumpert or start Dellavedova and give yourself more defense, and then, you know, have Love save him for when Azili and Spates are on the floor. You know, he's just going to struggle no matter who he guards just because they run so many pick and rolls, and he's not a great pick and roll defender. But I think if you're Cleveland, you can at least live with Azili and Spates beating you rather than the Splash Brothers or Iguodala or Draymond. Yeah. So that's the big adjustment that I'm keeping an eye out on in game two. Do you think the Warriors bench is going to have another game like they did in game one?
I don't. I mean, that was incredible. I mean, Sean Livingston to go, you know, for 18 points, I think, almost perfect shooting. Leandro Barbosa, right. 5 for 5 from the field. You know, that was incredible to see. And, you know, I don't think they'll match that game one performance, but I still think that their bench is significantly better than the Cavs bench. And you saw it there. I mean, you know, Shumpert, Dellavedova, and Channing Frye, I guess those are the big three coming off the Cavs bench. Mm-hmm. I don't think they match the competition level of that Warriors bench.
Yeah, I'm right with you. I do think they need to play Channing Frye more. I think he only got 7 minutes in game one.
Yeah.
So that needs to, he needs to see more court time. Because the Cavs really rampaged through the Eastern Conference bracket with with that lineup of Delly, Shumpert, Richard Jefferson, LeBron, and Frye. And I don't remember if we saw that at all in game one, or if we did, it was very limited time. So, you know, I think you got to go back there a little bit more. But yeah, I think asking, what was it, 45-10, I think, was the bench scoring disparity. Yeah, I don't think you're going to get that again either. But at the same time, you're also not going to get Klay and Steph only limited to 20 points. So if Golden State can keep winning the battle of the bench, I mean, this series, it's over before it started. So it sounds like we're both on the same page in terms of the overall series. Do you think Cleveland pulls this one out tonight?
I don't. I think that out of all the games in this series, this might be the biggest blowout. I think the Warriors win big. I would say like 25
that win
by tonight. I think it's going to be a blowout. I think Curry and Thompson are just going to come out firing. And, you know, I don't think the Cavs will have any answers tonight. And I think, hopefully, you know, there's no more ball taps by Dellavedova because he really got Andre Iguodala going in that last game. You know, I think Andre hit like 3 or 4 straight shots after that.
And, yeah.
You know, they just blew him out from that point forward. So I just think offensively, this is going to be where Golden State really puts their mark on the series and, you know, sways everything entirely. And, I just don't see the Cavs having any chance.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that last year they won game one in overtime, and then the Cavs won the next two. So, you know, I think they're going to be well aware of that fact, and I think that's going to help them avoid a letdown. Like, they know going up 1-0 means nothing, because if the Cavs steal game two, like, that's all they had to do. They only had to steal one game, and then they have home court now. Yeah. I saw this stat from Dan Feldman of NBC Sports. I'm not sure if it's just in terms of the finals, or if it's, I assume the whole playoffs. But game one losers have won game two 44% of the time. For LeBron's teams, it's 69%.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think I saw this from, I think it was ESPN Stats and Info had a graphic about like what happened the last 10 times a LeBron James team lost game one. And I'm pretty sure they won game two every single time. Wow. So I'm not going to go out on the limb and say it's a 25-point blowout like you, but yeah, I'm with you. I think Golden State is going to take control of the series, win game two. And then I think you're right. I think at least Cleveland gets one at home, hopefully game three. So then game four is just going to be a bloodbath. But I'm with you. I'm sticking with Golden State in five. It sucks. Like if OKC had made it, I think that's a much more competitive series. And I think Cleveland at least has a chance, but this is just such a bad matchup for them. I feel really bad for the Cavs and for Cavs fans because this team is good enough to win a title. It just happened to run into a historic juggernaut.
Yeah, and I mean, if the Raptors can get two games on the Cavs, I mean, I don't think there's any reason why, the Warriors can't win in five.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. Well, that's going to do it for us at the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. I'd like to extend a special thanks to our guest, Jeff McMenamin. Again, you can find him at Sixers Blog on Twitter. Check out bballbreakdown.com for all of your finals coverage. We've got recaps going up after every game and some other analysis. We're also going to ramp up our draft coverage and our off-season coverage starting this week. I've got a couple things going up about the CBA and about contracts, so keep an eye out for that stuff. Jeff, thanks for hopping on, man. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian.
All right, take care.